I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's show, Monkey Business. We'll hear my conversation with Francine Prose, author of the new novel, Mr. Monkey. The book is a humorous account of an off Broadway production and pokes fun at the world of theater. We'll also hear my interview with Daniel Smith, who wrote about living with anxiety in his book, Monkey Mind. The book has been praised for its accurate portrayal of living an anxious life with humor and bravery. But first, we'll hear from primatologist Frans de Waal about the morality of apes, how their behavior gives us a better understanding of how we humans have developed our notions of what's right and wrong. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. We're going ape this hour, and we begin monkeying around by listening to my interview with primatologist and philosopher Frans de Waal. He joined us to discuss his research on the empathy of monkeys. Yes, these primates often act aggressively and selfishly, but they also show signs of caring. And he believes his observations have given him some insight into how we humans have developed our ability to share, to care, and to love each other. He then takes the leap into religion and how humans have tied their rationale for empathetic behavior to notions of God. Frans de Waal discussed his thoughts and findings in his book, The Bonobo and the Atheist. Let's take a listen. Your book is largely about the research on chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest living relatives, but they're different. I mean, these two species, they're different from each other.
These two are very different. So anthropologists have always preferred the chimpanzee to compare us with, because chimpanzees are aggressive and wage war, and the males kill males in other territories, and they have strong hierarchies. And for some reason, this was very popular, because, of course, anthropologists believe that humans advanced as a species by wiping out everybody else. That's actually a problematic proposition, because we now know that humans have 4% DNA of our DNA is Neanderthal DNA, which means that instead of wiping out the Neanderthals, we bred with them. And so sex was part of the story. They don't like the bonobo for the reason that the bonobo is not aggressive, has a lot of sex. And my view is that maybe our history has more bonobo elements than they want to admit, and less chimpanzee elements of violence and so on.
So should we think of bonobos as hippies?
Yeah, they are sort of.
The '60s.
They are sort of the hippies of the primate world, because they have female dominance. So they're very popular with the feminist community for that reason. They have lots of sex in all sorts of combinations, so they're very popular with the gay community for that reason. So they are sort of the politically correct primate. But the reason they have so much sex is probably partly to keep the aggression under control, and they're very good at it.
So what you actually have in the beginning of the book, a description. These are chimps, actually. A chimp, one called Daisy, one called Amos. Hmm. Amos is seriously ill. But you observe and write about something that Daisy does, and perhaps this helps us understand what empathy might look like, at least coming from a chimpanzee.
So Amos was a very popular male with the chimpanzees, also very popular with us, actually. He was a beautiful male, but he got terribly ill, and he was sitting in a caged area, whereas all the other chimps were outdoors and outside. But we had cracked the door to his area so that other chimps could access him. And Daisy, who's a good friend of his, female, she would come over and stroke him and groom him, and he would lean to the crack of the door to have her do that. But at some point, she started shoving wood wool towards him, which the chimps used to build nests and to sleep on. And he was not accepting it. And so she started pushing the wool behind his back, between his back and the wall. And very much, it looked very much like the way humans put pillows behind a patient who's in the hospital to make them comfortable. And since Daisy herself is a big woodwool user herself, she loves that stuff, she must have been imagining how he would feel if he could lean back against that stuff. And so she was doing that. And that made me think of perspective taking, because empathy in general, of being sensitive to the emotions of others and caring for others, is not uniquely primate. But taking the perspective of somebody else, sort of understanding how someone might feel under certain circumstances, that gets us close to human kind of empathy.
Well, it raises questions about identity. You know, who am I and who are you? About attachment, about what it is to feel for someone else, and this notion that I am. I won't say somebody. I don't know if I can say that, but that I exist separate from you.
Yeah. So children, for example, when they reach the age of mirror self-recognition, they start to recognize themselves in the mirror. That's the age where their empathy becomes more complex, because at that point they can draw a line between themselves and the other. So instead of fusing with the other, and if you're crying, I'm crying, like babies do that already, which is a very simple form of empathy, they start now to draw a line between themselves and the other, which allows them to take the perspective of somebody else. And there are a few animals, of course, who can recognize themselves in mirrors. We have done ourselves the elephant mirror test. Chimpanzees can do it. Bonobos can do it. Humans can do it after a certain age. And so the species who can recognize themselves in the mirror, they usually have more complex forms of empathy.
You've also done some interesting research, I guess, on this notion of fairness. A bonobo, Pan Bashiba, did I say that name right?
Pan Banisha.
Did some, I mean, showed a kind of generosity, I guess, in dealing with treats that she was getting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's purely generosity. What happened in that case, she was being trained for a certain task and getting lots of goodies for it, like M&Ms and raisins and good stuff that the bonobos usually don't get. And other bonobos were watching her from a distance that she normally lives with. And at some point, she stopped doing the task and she waved her hand to the others until the others also got some of the goodies, and then she continued. And so, yes, you could look at it as an act of generosity. You could also look at it, well, she might get into trouble later on. If she takes all this good stuff and they get nothing, and then later we reunite the bonobos, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's actually, fairness is an interesting concept, because I think fairness is not necessarily regulated by empathy. It's regulated by having good relationships, and if you have a fair distribution, it's easier to maintain them than if you have an unfair distribution.
And because I called it generosity, are there also risks of ascribing certain traits that we would think of as human traits to, in this case, to primates?
Well, I tend to take the position that if an animal is very closely related to us and does similar things under similar circumstances, we have to come up with a similar concept to explain it. So I know that there are psychologists and people who work on animals who are very conservative in their terminology and say we should avoid anthropomorphism, which is fine if you see, for example, fish doing something similar to humans. Yes, there's probably a different explanation for what the fish are doing. But a chimpanzee or bonobo is as close to us genetically as a horse is to a zebra. Now, if a horse and a zebra do similar stuff under similar circumstances, we're certainly going to come up with a similar explanation for it. And I would apply the same rule to human and primate behavior.
So can we say that chimps and bonobos, that they're moral creatures?
I wouldn't call them moral. And I've never called a chimpanzee or bonobo a moral being in the human sense. I think they have a lot of the ingredients that we have built into our moral system, such as caring about others, caring about rules, following rules, punishing those who deviate. All these things can be observed in them, empathy, sense of fairness, and so on. But to have real morality the way we do, there's additional elements. So, for example, we reason about and we try to justify why we have certain rules, and we try to seek consistency. We have a discussion about whether if you're for the death penalty, you should be for abortion, or the kind of discussions we have. And so that sort of thing, of course, doesn't happen really in chimpanzees and bonobos. And we also try to objectify these rules. And so the moral rules that we live by, we, for example, I live by, you live by, we feel everyone in the world should live by these rules. And so we think that the rules are universal, and I don't think chimpanzees particularly care about that issue.
At least not yet in their evolution. But it also seems, and you had mentioned philosophers earlier on, that not that you're challenging this notion about the sort of logic of ethical or moral behavior, but saying it's so much more than that, that we have to include biology when we understand about ethical moral behavior.
Yeah, so what happened is that at first moral rules came from God and came from religion. And then after the Enlightenment, the philosophers said, no, we don't necessarily need God, but it comes from reason and logic. And so the philosophers had a prominent place in providing this reason and logic. But it's still a top-down view of morality where you say, humans don't really know how to behave. Someone ought to tell them how to behave. If it's not to the religious leaders, it's going to be the philosophers who's going to tell them. But I'm much more of the school, which is very popular at the moment among neuroscientists and biologists, of a bottom-up view of morality, where we say morality comes out of interactions and social tendencies between people, sort of consensus building among people of how we should behave. And the top-down normative features of morality, which do exist, they come sort of secondarily. Yeah.
Yeah. But are you also saying, I mean, there is this, and you write about it in the book, this veneer theory of morality, the idea that underneath us we're just wild, you know, a cauldron of nasty tendencies. I think I'm quoting you there. That's a view of human nature, is that we're essentially bad, and we have this overlay of morality that forces us to be good.
That's a view that was actually popular in biology. It was not a Darwinian view, but during the 70s and 80s and 90s, biologists such as Richard Dawkins and Robert Wright and other people, they started promoting this view that we are inherently selfish and competitive, and there's really no room for moral evolution. Just like Huxley, who was a contemporary of Darwin, who also saw no room for the evolution of morality, the biologists sort of talked us into this corner where, on the one hand, they said evolution cannot explain morality. We don't believe in religion. Well, then there's nothing left. If biology and religion are not there, then I don't know how you would ever explain the reason we have morality. And so Darwin saw this problem, recognized this, and Darwin proposed that evolution can produce these moral tendencies. Now, the veneer theory is basically the idea that we are so 100% selfish that we can never overcome that, maybe only culturally or religiously, and that we naturally don't have any tendency to be good or nice to others. Mm. Now, this whole thing is now sort of forgotten, because after the year 2000, the economists started to find that we are much more cooperative than they thought. Then the neuroscientists found that if we give to charity and do nice things, there's pleasure centers in our brain that light up, meaning that we take pleasure in being nice to other people. Then primatologists such as myself said, well, a lot of our close relatives, they have actually genuine altruism going on. And the anthropologists started playing the ultimatum game all over the world and finding sense of fairness in all people of the world. Around the year 2000, the whole veneer theory collapsed and is now nearly forgotten 10 years later.
Your book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist. Mm-hmm. And you have at the very end, what would a bonobo tell an atheist? Expand on that. I found that an interesting section.
And actually, in that discussion that I put at the end between the bonobo and the atheist, the bonobo grants a lot of ground to the atheist.
He's very nice to the atheist.
Yeah, he's actually very nice to the atheist. And so I don't think atheists should be too upset with my book. The bonobo basically says, slow down on that question of whether God exists or not. That is not really the interesting question. He says the interesting question is, where does morality come from? And then, of course, the bonobo also explains that we shouldn't look too much at social insects, which has been done so much, but they don't have the empathy mechanism. They have lots of altruism, which is probably achieved in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not denying that they are not perfectly cooperative and altruistic, but they don't have that empathy mechanism that makes you respond to the distress of others that all the mammals have. And so that's what the bonobo tries to explain about it.
What would a bonobo say to a fundamentalist? Have you thought about that?
To a biblical literalist, you mean? Yeah. He would say, well, close the book for a while and start thinking about the world and look at the evidence, you know. That's, I think, what he would say.
That was my 2010 interview with primatologist Frans de Waal about his book, The Bonobo and the Atheist. When we get back from the break, we continue our Monkey Business edition of the show when we hear from Daniel Smith about his book, Monkey Mind. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Monkey Business edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. currently it seems like our psyches are being consumed by anxiety as the 2016 election has heightened tensions and fears of the voters. But for some people, anxiety is a way of life. This was true for author Daniel Smith, who felt the need to articulate what living the anxious life feels like for those who may not fully understand. His book, Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety, has been praised for its ability to combine humor with the brutal reality of living with this disorder. He joined us in 2013 to discuss. Let's listen. Are you anxious about doing this interview?
Strangely, I'm not. I was anxious beforehand for a while. I was biting my nails, biting my cuticles. But something about once you're in the middle of it, it cuts off the fear of the future, which is what anxiety often is, and sort of slams you right into the present moment. And for me, talking to someone even live in front of an audience, mm-hmm. all my anxiety goes away. I used to do some performance in college, and beforehand, I was an absolute wreck always, and felt tortured. But once I was up there, the anxiety dissipated. It was like meditating. It was like being always in the present moment. So something about that. Not everyone who's anxious right. is so lucky, of course.
Well, I'm glad you're not anxious, and we're happy to have you here. You, though, describe your anxiety as cerebral, and you have a wonderful phrase describing, I guess, how your brain works, a kind of drama queen of the mind. Help us understand what goes on inside your head that makes you so anxious.
Right. Well, the term that I think clinicians use is catastrophizing. So that anything that happens, even the most mundane thing, a thought might occur to me regarding that event. And it could be anything mundane like which salad dressing to put on my garden salad. Should it be balsamic vinaigrette? It should be blue cheese. Now, it seems like a very mundane choice, a very pedestrian choice. But for me, my mind immediately starts making a logical progression from that moment to catastrophic events. If I choose the wrong salad dressing, I'll have a bad lunch and I won't be very nice to the person next to me. That person next to me will say something terrible about me, who will say something to my editor, who will cancel my book contract, which will lead to me to being impoverished and then homeless. I'll take up drugs. I'll end up having to sell my body for money on the streets, come down with a horrible disease and die disgraced and alone.
Wow. A vivid imagination. Yes.
Yeah, dramatic, melodramatic mind. It is like having a drama queen of the mind. That's one great metaphor, at least for my anxiety.
Well, it's interesting because you do talk about your family and how you experience anxiety differently. And it sounds like, as you say, with your brother, it's more physical, maybe more kind of heart palpitations. But for you, it is this cerebral, your overactive brain, I guess.
Yeah, and I think my anxiety focuses on failure and on things going wrong, whereas my brother Scott, poor Scott, is having his little brother expose his anxieties to Aww. The world. But I think he could handle it.
Yeah.
Scott's is focused on illness. He's a hypochondriac, basically, so that, like a lot of people, he feels a twinge in his chest or muscle tightness, and his mind goes to heart attack. Cancer, and he ends up in the hospital having a bunch of expensive tests.
Really?
Whereas for me, yeah, he's, you know, like a lot of people that happens to, they have a panic attack, they end up in the back of an ambulance. Emergency rooms see tons of people every year, thousands who are convinced they're having heart attacks, but are really just in the middle of a moment of panic or deep anxiety. I don't go there. Although there are physical sensations for my anxiety. For some reason, I get fixated on the more abstract failure, separation, loss.
Do you feel like the world is a dangerous place?
The world is a dangerous place.
It certainly can be.
And there's an aspect of pessimism, it seems like you might be getting at, that my anxiety, at least, is related to a sense that the world is a dangerous place and the world is a threat to me. Anything can go wrong at any moment and can lead through a cascade of events to my ruination. It sounds crazy the more I describe it out loud.
But it also sounds logical. I mean, in many ways, humans survived because we reacted to dangerous situations and we had that, you know, the fight or flight response, and we were able to evolve and survive.
Yes, and except instead, there are no wolves trying to chase me down. There's just salad dressing in front of me. So it's right. I think it is very much this primitive impulse that is now channeled into these very mundane things, which is maybe one of the reasons why anxiety is considered a very modern affliction.
Because your mind has to go somewhere, so it goes to salad dressing instead of wolves?
Yeah, because we're not hunters and gatherers anymore trying to escape predators, or at least most of us aren't. We are people who go to the grocery store and try to decide between Frosted Flakes and Cheerios. And we're faced with these choices, and our bodies, the mind is so absolutely great. It's a genius at fear. The fear response in human beings is vital. It's necessary. Without a fear response, we wouldn't have survived as a species. However, a lot of the things that we had to be fearful of are no longer threats, and yet we're stuck with the response.
You come from an anxious family, and of course that always raises that question about nature nurture, you know, in trying to understand why you have this chronic anxiety.
Yeah, and I think that it's both nature and nurture. I come, as I say in the book, from anxious stock, and it's inevitable that children of people who have these anxious tendencies and whose parents had those anxious tendencies are going to experience them as well. Maybe not inevitable, but probable. At the same time, my mother especially struggled with enormous anxiety. She suffered from panic attacks from the time she was a teenager. And to her great credit, she found a way to deal with them. And now in her 60s, she is far less anxious than she's ever been in her life. She's a therapist.
I was going to say, she's a therapist.
Yes, she went back to school to become a social worker, to get her degree, and to become a psychotherapist who specializes in the anxiety disorders. And I think, and she concurs, that this was a way of learning more about herself.
Well, it's interesting because you said she's a therapist and mm-hmm. helps people with their own anxiety and perhaps helping with her own anxiety. You write and have written a book about your anxiety, whether therapy and writing has the same kind of beneficial effect.
Writing has no therapeutic effect.
Okay, fair enough.
I get this question a lot. And, you know, you wrote a book about anxiety. Did it help you with the anxiety? And it didn't. It helped me to understand the anxiety. It helped me to understand anxiety in general. So maybe I'm being a little disingenuous because understanding is therapeutic as well. But the only thing that's therapeutic with anxiety is changing the habits of thought. And writing comes with its own problems and makes you terrified that your work is going to be received poorly. So it raises its own anxieties. The only thing that's therapeutic is learning that how your mind works. My mind works in a certain way. I tell myself things that are going to make me feel anxious. Once I recognize that and learn how to be mindful of it, I can then try to dig new pathways. The problem is I've been anxious for so long, since I'm a kid, and I'm in my 30s now, that the old pathway is always going to be there. It's like those wagon tracks that the old pioneers used to use to get across the country. So many wagon wheels would go in them that they'd be these packed earth ruts. They'll always be there and the wheels will always slip in them. The only thing you can do is every day dig new tracks and dig a new pathway and keep digging them forever, because otherwise you're just going to slip back in the old ways of thinking. That's been my experience.
What's interesting, though, is that you use cognitive behavioral therapy as a way, I guess, of talking to yourself about what you're thinking. And you also use meditation, which I'm a failed meditator in that whenever I try it, my head just gets consumed with thoughts. It seems like such a contradictory or perhaps interesting way of dealing with your anxiety.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're a failed meditator. I mean, that's what happens. Someone said to me, and I'm a failed meditator too, in that I know it helps, but I don't do it.
Yes.
Because I'm a dummy. And even though I know that it helps, I don't know why I'm so dumb. I know what helps me, and yet I fail to do it every day. But that's what happens when you sit in silence, is that the thoughts come. Someone once said to me that the brain is like a gland, and what it secretes are thoughts. The secret of meditating, well, it's not a secret, I suppose. The rule is you allow yourself to do that, and then you just bring yourself back to the breath. It's a way of disciplining yourself from allowing your own mind to go off on those catastrophic tangents, those melodramatic tangents, and to bring yourself back. And that's why they call it a practice. And it has in common with cognitive behavior therapy that mindfulness, that awareness of the mind is something that does things that you might not want it to do, that makes thoughts that you might not want them to make. And you need to have some way of responding to that, some way to discipline your own mind, which is all that that is. That's what both of them are.
Well, in fact, your book, Monkey Mind, I mean, that's a Buddhist term.
It is. I took that from the Buddhist literature, and I just found it so evocative, such a beautiful term to describe what it's like to live with a mind that's prone to anxiety, that's prone to this chronic dread and fear, because it feels like monkeys swinging around in your head and screeching and doing the disgusting flinging of their filth that monkeys do and not stopping. And learning to tame those monkeys, learn to put a collar on them, is the job.
But it sounds like with anxiety, there is a lot of I mean, that there's a lot of focus on self.
Oh, it's awful. That's the great incantation. I. That's anxiety. It is being locked into your own head. And it is terrible if you want to be a good and loving person. Mm. When you're anxious, everything is about you and your own welfare. And it can be very hard to have productive, happy relationships when you're in the midst of that. It's like locked-in syndrome, I thought of it at one point. Like that book which was made into a movie, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Oh, indeed. Fantastic movie, yes.
Fantastic and a wonderful book, and you're stuck in your own head. And it feels that way. It feels as if you cannot escape your own skull. And that makes it very difficult to see people well, to see them and to love them. And if that's an aspiration of yours, if you want to be a good person, it also comes with a great deal of guilt because you don't want to be selfish. And yet, and yet it's there. It seizes you like a fever. And it's a fever of selfhood, of self-obsession.
You described the anxiety that you had at camp. You also had anxiety about being dropped off at Brandeis, so where you went to college. It sounds like you not just hid in the library, but you found great comfort reading books like Philip Roth's novels, that was a way for you to understand what you were going through. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Yeah, I had escaped the library because it was – it afforded some solitude. And I found that in books, I had a great therapeutic tool. I'd been in therapy before and I didn't quite like it. You had to keep answering questions. if a book, and you had to sit there for the whole 45 minutes, otherwise you were rude or you're wasting money. With a book, you can open up the cover, and if it comforted you and it helped you and you taught you something, you can keep going. If it made you anxious, you could slam the cover shut and replace it on the shelf and get a new one. And they don't talk back, which is a nice thing. So Philip Roth, when I discovered Philip Roth's novels, it was almost like discovering the Rosetta Stone for my own anxiety. We had very similar backgrounds, by which I mean we had slightly, or at least the characters, I should say, because I don't know Philip Roth and I don't know his life or biography that well. But the characters had histrionic Jewish mothers. There seemed to be an ethnic aspect to anxiety that I found quite true to my own experience. Often the dilemma that a Philip Roth character goes through is as follows. I want the love of my family. I cherish the love of my family. The love of my family is enormously important to me and defines me on the one hand. On the other hand, I wish I can escape the love and affection of my family. I wish I could separate. I wish I could service my own ego. I wish I could be a bad person and not want to be the mensch all the time. How do you do these two things? You're being pulled in two different directions at the same time. And you can't get out of your head the voices of your family, of your parents, of your superego, who think they know what they want, what's good for you, and perhaps do, and you might believe them at the same time as you resent them.
Daniel, I just want to quote something that you wrote. The headline was, Do the Jews Own Anxiety? And you talk about making up a baseball team or putting a baseball team together made up of anxious players. And you said, last Rosh Hashanah, I asked a group of friends this question, and the answer I got suggested that the team would be exclusively Jewish. Responses included, but were not limited to, the following: the Los Angeles Kvetches, the Brooklyn Nazi Dodgers, the Kansas City Moils, the Chicago Schlubs, the Miami Michiganas, the Westchester Rhinoplasties, the Hollywood Ingestives, and my favorite, this is you, a late entry from my brother Scott, the Upper West Side Atavans. The idea that if you were to put a baseball team together of all anxious players, they would all be Jewish.
Yeah, and it turns out that it's not true.
Exactly.
The Jews have not cornered the market on anxiety. It's a universal emotion. And if you put together that baseball team, you'd have people like Soren Kierkegaard and William James and Charles Darwin, who suffered terribly from panic attacks and crippling nervous illness, which they've tried to discover the cause of for many years. And half of the Book of Saints, the lives of the saints, those people would have to be in there. But the Jews are enormously good. And I should point out that despite the fact that my last name is Smith, that is what they call an Ellis Island name. It was either changed by my great-grandfather or by a clerk at Ellis Island. And it was originally Gamulski. But the Jews have been better than anyone else at dramatizing anxiety, at showing the dilemma of what it's like to be someone who can't get out of their own head. And, of course, we all know – we can all talk about the great examples, Philip Roth, sure, the Coen brothers movies, and, of course, Woody Allen. And there's good reasons for that. But I also think that it's very much an immigrant thing, an American immigrant thing. The other immigrant groups who come to the United States become very good at that, at representing anxiety once they start to experience the generational dilemmas. Do I stick with the traditional from which I've received so much, or do I assimilate and try to become individual and individualistic and independent? There's enormous anxiety in that tension.
That was my 2013 conversation with Daniel Smith, author of Monkey Mind, a memoir of anxiety. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my interview with writer Francine Prose. Her new novel is called Mr. Monkey. Stay with us.
I've seen a sign of you. I only heard of you. Bogging up the big monkey man. He's not alive. He's not
alive. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're going to close out today's show by listening to a portion of my interview with author Francine Prose. Prose has long been a respected author, having written 18 novels and 8 books of nonfiction. Her latest book is called Mr. Monkey, a humorous work of fiction that pokes fun at the world of off Broadway and the lives of those in musical theater. Let's take a listen. One of your characters, in fact, the playwright, cries every time he goes to the zoo and sees the monkeys in the cages.
Yeah. Well, they are all just a tiny rung below us, if that's even on the evolutionary ladder.
Just a tiny rung.
A tiny rung. I mean, sometimes it's not clear how tiny, but yeah, tiny.
Well, not to give too much away, but at the very beginning, you describe what Mr. Monkey, the children's book, what it's about. So, mm-hmm. What is the book about?
Well, it's about a woman from New York who's a primatologist, I guess you could call her, and she goes to Africa to study monkeys, and she gets involved in the situation, which actually happens, where poachers are killing monkeys to basically get the land so they can develop it for oil. And she adopts this little baby monkey whose parents have been killed, and then she herself is killed. So her family back in New York adopts that baby monkey, who becomes the little sibling of the children in New York. And then the monkey, as a kind of party trick, learns how to steal wallets at parties and then is accused by the evil girlfriend of of really stealing her Hermes wallet and so forth and so on. I mean, that was fun to make up, and it was fun to make up a whole bad children's musical with the songs and dances and everything.
Do you have songs in your head when that are part of this musical?
I'm still trying.
Is there sheet music somewhere?
I'm still trying to get rid of those songs in my head.
Are you afraid that someone is going to make a musical about Mr. Monkey the Musical?
If I get those little royalty checks, that's okay.
Have you ever acted you yourself? Have you ever been in a play?
Not since grade school. I was the Angel Gabriel in our grade school Christmas pageant, but only because I was the tallest kid in the class, the tallest girl in the class. So, I mean, forget the fact that the Angel Gabriel was actually male, if angels have genders. So I got to do that, but that was the end of my acting, beginning and end of my acting career.
I've interviewed actors who talk about what acting is really being real. It's about not acting. But she and some of the others in this play are forced to pretend to act. I mean, it's one of those really strange situations, I think, that actors can get themselves stuck in.
Well, they're real actors, and they do what actors – I mean, I've never been an actor, but I've known actors, and it's fun and interesting to hang out with them because they're always watching and watching the way people's little gestures or the way they walk and thinking if they can use that sometime when they're – so these actors in Mr. Monkey have done all that, but then they're doing it in the service of Mr. Monkey, so it's, right. You know
– It's complicated.
It's complicated.
This is a funny novel. Is that something new for you, to write funny?
They've, you know, except for the last one, Chameleon Club, they've all been sort of funny. And it's partly, I write partly to entertain myself. You know, if I'm sitting at the computer and laughing, I think, okay, good day, funny for the writer, funny for the reader, I'm happy. But it's one of the only books I've written that has a happy ending. And I either have indeterminate endings or unhappy endings, but I was shocked when I got near the end and I realized that this was going to be positive, redemptive, and sort of a love story that worked out. I hadn't planned it, but that's how it went.
And that's how writing goes? I mean, for people that don't write, they feel like, well, you're the writer. You're in control of the story.
Ha ha.
I wish.
Well, you know, I have friends who have outlines and they know exactly what's going to happen and exactly how long the book is going to be. I don't do that. I've never done that. I write a sentence and then write another sentence. And the reason that each chapter in this book has a different narrator was I would get to the end of the chapter and say, okay, who interested me in the last chapter? And let me see how far I can go with this. So, you know, it starts with Margot and then goes to the child actor who plays the monkey. And then I thought, I'm just going to spin this out as far as I can. So I made a chapter from the grandfather's point of view in the audience, who, of course, is me disguised. You know, all you have to do is change the gender and in theory, nobody recognizes you. And then the grandson. And then my granddaughter, the same granddaughter, told me that one of her teachers, this must have been in kindergarten, came to class and told the kindergarten class, she goes, every night at 11, I take a sleeping pill. And I went, whoops. You know, and I mean, as someone who teaches myself, I know that there are many occasions on which you say something that you didn't quite mean to say to your class, and then you go, okay, I hope everyone forgets I just said it. So the minute I heard this, I thought, oh, you know what, I want to write a chapter from the teacher's point of view, and then it just kind of spun out. And all I knew was that I wanted to bring it all the way back around to Mr. Monkey the play. So it spins kind of way out and then comes back.
There's a sentence from Darwin that Adam loves, something about how humans would never have been classified as a separate species if humans hadn't been the ones doing the classification. Is that, I know that's Darwin, it's Adam, is that you as well?
Well, by the time I'd finished reading as much as I had to read about monkeys to write this, it was me as well.
Just feeling like what we if someone else had been doing the classification, we might have been on par with monkeys or maybe below monkeys?
Well, you know, I think only a few kinds of monkeys treat one another as badly as humans have done historically. So, you know, the bonobos, for example, are much more peaceful than humans. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to rate us on qualities such as civility, they might be a little ahead of us.
And, Beno, I mean, I'm curious about the books that you had on your shelf. about monkeys?
Books about evolution, books about primate biology, books about monkey behavior, books about Darwin, books by Darwin. And they were fun to read and interesting.
Well, what's interesting in this musical production of the book, they have to take out references to evolution and you know, other, I guess, what considered to be controversial ideas. Does that often happen, you think?
I think so. And also they're playing to an audience. They're trying to play to the widest possible audience. So heaven forfend they offend anyone in the audience. And they're hoping, of course, that Mr. Monkey has gone national. So they want it to be able to play in theaters all over the country.
Now, the original book is written by a guy named Ray Ortiz. He's a Vietnam vet. Tell us a little bit about him.
He's a Vietnam vet, and he has been suffering from PTSD before that was even a diagnosis, and he knows it. But he's at the very end, there are stories that are going around in his mind that have been haunting him about monkeys in Vietnam. And at the very end, there's a disclosure of what one of those stories is. But nonetheless, he is obsessed by monkeys, and he will every so often go to the Bronx Zoo and just stand there weeping in front of the monkey cage.
And kind of feeling like a sellout himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially every time the musical, I mean, he doesn't like the musical for reasons one can hardly blame him. So every time the musical is performed, it opens that wound again.
The idea that he did something for commercial reasons rather than for artistic reasons or something about his inner life?
Well, in his original plan, the monkey was going to come from Vietnam and be adopted by Puerto Ricans in New York, which he is. And the editor says, do you want this to be a niche book? They have to be adopted by rich white people on the Upper East Side. So everything changed in that way.
Are you saying something about publishing?
I'm saying something about the culture.
The culture of?
of our culture. I mean, commercialism and the idea of pleasing the maximum number of people and not being political in a way that people might find troublesome.
I was also thinking, because I know you're a writer, that it's also about what it is to be a writer and to have written something and then to see other people take it on, either readers interpreting it in different ways or it becomes a movie, if you're lucky, I guess, or a TV show or a musical or a play. And that as the writer, you have to, in a sense, give it up to other people to do with it what they will.
You have no control.
No control.
I mean, a friend of mine years ago, a much older writer friend of mine said, well, you know, what you're doing is creating a mirror. And people see themselves in it, and all you can do is create the mirror. I mean, in a way, writers are lucky compared, for example, to novelists compared to screenwriters. I mean, the book is the book, but you know, you write a screenplay, it's like a recipe for lemon cake. I mean, you know, no one's going to make it the same way. Yeah,
right, right, and just they're going to make it their own.
Mm-hmm.
That's happened to you. Or do you? How?
No, I was very fortunate. The only movie they've made. No, this is not true. They made Household Saints out of one of my novels, and I love the movie. And apparently, they've made a film out of Blue Angel, but I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know what the story is.
And you loved it because you said this is still my novel. I still recognize this.
Oh, it's so beautiful! It's so beautiful. And every so often, I see it. It shows up on TV late at night, and you know, and it's been so long now. I think it came out in, I don't know, 93 or something. You know, it'll take me a few minutes and I'll think, this is really good. What is this? And then I'll think, oh, yeah. It's Household Saints, my novel.
I'm curious because you've written, I think, more than 20 books at this point. Mm-hmm. Does it ever get easier or is there a point in which you become a writer and you kind of know how to do this? Even, of course, dealing with fiction, which takes you into a whole other world.
You're reinventing the wheel, I am, every single time. It's never easier. But, you know, but part of the fun and part of the challenge is to do something that's more difficult every time. So, you know, there are things you could do that would be just like things you've done before and just hit that ball straight out of the park. But it's not as interesting. I mean, you want to do something that's harder. And in this case, Mr. Monkey, I didn't even realize this when I started. I wanted to do something that was just closer to the bone for me, that was closer to the heart. So that, I mean, this book is much No one would ever know how autobiographical it is.
Oh, really?
But I think it is, and not because the characters resemble me, et cetera, but because the feelings they have are so close to feelings I've had,
and the feelings of all of 12-year-old Adam, and I mean,
I
all,
was 12. Right?
Yes, yeah.
Not a boy, but and particularly the grandfather. I mean, that, you know, the one that is most closely. I mean, you know, everyone says, and it's true. I have 4 grandchildren now. Everyone says, and it's true, it's the best thing, and it is the best thing. But in some ways, it's painful, too, because they're not yours. They're not yours. They're not, I mean, everyone says, well, you can give them back, and you don't have to, so forth and so forth. That's true. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, the word yearning keeps showing up through the novel, and there's something about that in that relationship, which is impossible to be satisfied.
And not to be too maudlin here, but I assume having grandchildren also means that you're going to die at some point. I mean, it's the next generation is born, and that means at some point you or grandparents, we're going to, if we're grandparents, we're going to disappear. We're going to go away.
Well, funny you should say that, because just last weekend, my 5-year-old granddaughter said to me, you know, when I'm a grown up, you're not going to be around. She says, you're going to be dead like your mom. And I said, okay, can we pick out my coffin now, or can we just wait a little while? She says, so my mom and dad. I said, what about you? She goes, nah, that's never going to happen.
Oh, there you go. In fact, the grandfather, I guess, is a bit of a stand-in for you in this novel. The grandfather thinks one consolation of age is desensitization. You worry less about saying the wrong thing. When you were young, you think you'll die from shame, but from time, you'll learn that embarrassment won't kill you. There's another reason why the young despise and fear the elderly. They have no manners, no social sense. They'll say anything, which is so funny because oftentimes that's what older people say about younger people, right? They're so ill-mannered.
Well, there's a scene. I mean, that happens during a scene, which also is based on something I experienced, which was I went to a dinner at my son and daughter-in-law's house, and they're fabulous. I mean, we get along beautifully, but they had all these parents of my granddaughter's friends over, and it was, you know, child culture in Brooklyn, and I'm sure there must be a version in Philadelphia. I mean, it's everywhere, you know, where you were not allowed to talk about anything except the children's schools and what would be the best school and the nurturing school and the progressive school and this school and that school. If I would try to introduce a book or a movie or something like that, they would all look at me, you know, what was I even talking about? Plus, their sweetly patronizing attitude, like I was some, you know, escapee from the nursing home that had wound up there somehow.
I'm curious about how you did raise your children, since you talk about how your children are raising their children. I assume you and I are probably about the same age, so raising kids in the, 70s?
Yeah, 60s, yeah, yeah. 70s. My kids were born in 78 and 82. I think we were much looser than my children are with their kids. I mean, my grandchildren actually have structures, whereas my own children, they could outlast us, no matter what we did. You know, they were more stubborn than we were, and finally we'd say, you know, whatever.
So give in.
But my kids are quite strict in a good way with their children, and it doesn't seem to have hurt them.
And how were you raised?
I was raised, you know, it skipped a generation. I mean, I was from the generation where my dad would say, "What's this A- doing on your report card?"
Oh, really? So, wow. Yeah. That's so serious.
That was serious, yeah. But, you know, the jury is still out on how well any of this works or not. Right? I did become a fairly high achiever, so, you know, thanks, Dad.
In part to please your dad,
yeah,
you think?
Sure. I'm sure.
So was this a fun book to write for you?
It was really fun. It was really fun. And it was just, for one thing, because it was funny. And for another, because it just kind of swung along from character to character, and
like a monkey,
just, like a monkey on the vine, you know, the fake vines in the theater set, and it was constantly surprising me. I mean, when I got to the end, for example, I mean, there are 2 kind of shocking chapters. I won't give them away near the end, but I went like, "Whoa, where is this coming from?" And then at the very end, the director Roger, who everyone has just been despising all the way through, I thought, I can't redeem everyone in the novel, mm-hmm. and not Roger. I have to give him a heart, really. And so I was able to use all sorts of things that I've been wanting to use in novels for a long time. There's a little story of Tolstoy's that he thinks of that goes in there. And then to give it through Roger this kind of redemptive happy ending. So it was a real joy to write.
That was my conversation with author Francine Prose about her novel, Mr. Monkey. And that wraps up this week's Monkey Business edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific weekend.